a lot of talks by libertarians to libertarian audiences, and I am sure by socialists to socialist audiences, consist of preaching the converted, of telling people things they already believe, including how much smarter and better they are than everybody else. This is not a useful activity. It feels good. It doesn't convince anybody who doesn't already agree with you. And it makes the people who listen to you less able to convince other people. Because treating someone who disagrees with you as stupid and evil is not a good way of getting him to listen to you. I try to make my talks either something that the audience doesn't know or something they will disagree with. I'm trying to do the latter this time. So my topic is arguments libertarians shouldn't make, and I'm going to run through a number of them. The first one is the NAP. The second is the idea that property rights are easy, that all you have to do to make the world work is just say, this belongs to me and that belongs to you. The third is that laissez-faire solves everything, that any problem someone wants the government to solve could be solved by the market instead. The next one is that climate change either isn't happening or isn't our fault. And the final one is that anarchy is... Just stopped working? All right, it's working again. All right, let me start with the NAP. And I will begin with an example which I think was originated by Bill Bradford, who ran Liberty Magazine for many years until his death. We will assume that you fall off the porch of your ninth floor apartment. Fortunately, you catch the flagpole of the eighth floor apartment underneath, and just as you're about to climb in the window, the owner of the apartment comes into the room and says, I do not give you permission to use my property. Please let go. Do you? One of my versions of the same kind of problem is that a madman is murdering a crowd of people. There happens to be a rifle within your reach with which you could kill him. However, the rifle belongs to a generally hostile fellow who has made it very clear that he does not want anybody else to use his rifle under any circumstances. Do you violate his property rights by grabbing it and saving a dozen lives, and whether or not you do, should you? All right, the standard libertarian version of the NAP would say that you should let go of the flagpole and you should let the madman kill the people. My old version, which is sort of the same thing on a larger scale, is that an asteroid is heading for the Earth. It will destroy all life on Earth. By some bizarre set of circumstances, you could stop it. But stopping it requires you to steal an item worth a nickel from its just owner. He created it all by himself, and he doesn't give a damn if everybody on Earth dies. Do you, should you? All right. All of these are cases that involve a trade-off. And the trade-off is between respecting rights, which is certainly an important thing to do, and human life, which is also important. And the way libertarians tend to make their rights argument implies that respecting rights is infinitely important, and therefore you should never violate them, whatever the reasons. And I am arguing that that's not a defensible position, and we therefore shouldn't pretend to hold it. Right. What is a better and more modest version of the argument? It is that do not initiate coercion is a good rule of thumb. It allows any transaction that benefits both parties because they'll agree to it. And it allows many transactions that benefit one person by a lot and harms another by a little because they can bargain for compensation. But it does not always allow all transactions that create a large benefit for somebody at a small cost to someone else. And I will in a few minutes be running through the reasons that there are cases where one can't solve that kind of problem. Do not initiate coercion is also, I think, a legitimate moral rule. That is to say, all else being equal, compelling people is bad. So that I would say that if I can produce some small benefit in other terms by forcing you to do something, I shouldn't do it. But there are other bad things in the world as well. So a little coercion to avoid a lot of other bad things might be the right choice under some circumstances. Let me go to the next one, which is to some extent related to that. And that's the idea that private property, that property rights are basically a simple solution to a very wide range of issues and a sufficient solution. So let me give what I think is the sort of intuitive version that a lot of people have at the back of their minds. It's my land. I get to make the rules. I can do anything on my land. You cannot do anything that affects my land. When you turn on a light in your bedroom that I can see from my land, that means your photons are affecting my eyes on my land. Do you need my permission before you turn on the light? Suppose my house happens to be on my land right next to the border. You dig a large hole at the edge of your land, and my house slides into it. Which one of us has violated the other's rights? Part of the fun of studying law is discovering that when you're actually trying to implement property rights in the real world, they turn out to be a much more complicated set of ideas than when you're just making claims out in the air, so to speak. Now, one answer that you'll get to this by some libertarians is that only violations that do harm counts. So therefore, when your photons come onto my land, they're doing no damage, so therefore you don't need my permission. But of course, to do that, you have to claim that an external authority gets to decide whether it's doing harm. Well, but that looks like what we call eminent domain when the government does it. That is, my taking something, my doing something to your land, and then claiming that the cost I'm imposing on you is zero. And libertarians at least like to claim that no external agent can decide my values for me. That position leads to a variety of other problems, but I've got enough other things to talk about today. The correct way of understanding it, I think, is that what you own is not the land. What you own is a bundle of rights with regard to the land, and it is not clear what belongs in the bundle. That what I was doing in a law school for 20-some years was teaching the economic analysis of law, and one of the things that covers is the question of how you would decide what rights ought to be in the bundle pertaining to a particular piece of land, given that many rights actually pertain to two adjacent pieces of land, such as the examples that I was mentioning. If anybody really is curious about this at a level beyond what I can do in a talk, my book, Law's Order, can be read for free from my website and contains a much more extended discussion of this set of issues than I'm going to be giving here. Does the ownership of land include the right to prohibit trespass, even if the trespass does no harm? Can I forbid people from taking shortcuts across my land, which makes it easier for them to get where they're going, even if it does no harm? And if I claim I can, it's sort of interesting to ask how I got that right. That there is this sort of Lockean idea that you increase the value of the land by mixing your labor with it. But people could have walked over the land before anybody settled it. So how do I get the right to forbid them from doing so now? The right to lateral support. That is the right to have you not dig out the land right next to my house and have my house slide into the hole. This is, I should say, a real world issue in English common law. And the answer is that English common law held that I did have the right to lateral support, that to whatever support in the state of nature your ground gave to my ground. How about the right not to have my building shade your swimming pool? Does the bundle of rights associated with my land include a right to the sunlight that's falling on it? That's a real case, by the way. That was a Florida case involving two hotels. But there are more modern cases which involve solar panels and trees shading them. How about the right not to have my building block the current of air across your building with the result that your chimneys cease to draw? That's, again, a real English case, I think 19th, maybe 18th century, I think 19th century. All right. So as you can see, some rights relate to two different properties, as these demonstrate. And so using property rights to solve things, while it's indeed a very useful approach, is not the kind of simple, you know, check here approach that a lot of libertarians imagine it is. Let me go on to my next one, which is the idea, roughly speaking, that laissez-faire solves everything. That anytime somebody says there is a problem, how do we solve health insurance? How do we solve global warming? There is a tendency for libertarians to say all problems are the result of the government making things worse. If only you let people free, these problems would solve themselves. And there is a simple argument which supports this intuition, but unfortunately it's wrong. The simple argument is that individuals are rational. Each individual, therefore, is the best person to make choices for himself. Therefore, if each person is making the best choice for what he's doing, add that up, and everybody is making the best choice for all of us. Therefore, there is never a good reason for government to interfere. Why is that wrong? And the reason it's wrong is something called market failure, which is a deceptive term, because as the examples I'm about to offer you show you, it is not especially about markets. It's something that happens on markets, but happens in many other contexts. And I think the right definition of market failure is that it is situations where individual rationality does not produce group rationality, and therefore where the argument I just offered doesn't hold. And let me start with my favorite example. Some of you may have heard it before, since some of you have probably seen talks that overlap with this that are on YouTube or something. I want you to imagine that it's about 1,000 years ago and about 4,000 miles east of here, and you are one of a line of 10,000 men with spears, and the spears are pointed in that direction. And the reason the spears are pointed in that direction is there are another 10,000 men with spears on horseback who are coming at you. And you do a very quick cost-benefit calculation. And you say, if we all stand and keep our spears planted, with luck we can break their charge. And some of us will die, but most of us will live. If we run, horses run faster than we do, so I should stand. I'm sorry, I made a mistake. I said we. I don't control him and him. I only control me. If everybody else stands and I run, one fewer person out of 10,000 is very unlikely to change what happens, and I won't be one of the ones killed. If everybody else runs, my only hope is to run faster. Whatever everybody else is doing, it is in my interest to run. We all run. Most of us die. Welcome to the dark side of rationality. Right. So that's one example. Let me give you a much less exotic example, which some of you have experienced, and which I observed when I was teaching at UCLA. A little south of UCLA, there is the intersection of two streets, which the locals claimed was the busiest intersection in the world. It was maybe eight lanes each way, city streets, essentially. And you could see each day that the streets, the cars on Westwood try to make it across. The light goes red. Some of them are stuck in the intersection, preventing the cars on Wilshire from getting through. These cars gradually filter out of the intersection just in time for the cars in Wilshire to come by, have the light go red, and block them coming the other way around. So if you think about the logic of that situation, everybody would be better off. Everybody would get home faster if everybody behaved courteously and didn't pull into the intersection until he was sure he could get across. But any person who does that gets home later as a result. So it is again a situation where there is a conflict between individual rationality and group rationality. Let me now give you a third example, which is even more common, and probably you have all experienced it. You are in a restaurant or a bar having a pleasant conversation with your friends, and the only problem is that there are other people having conversations, and that makes it a little bit noisy, so it's a little bit hard to hear each other. So you've just got to talk a little bit louder so you can be heard. But unfortunately, everybody else is doing the same thing, so you have to talk still louder to be heard. And eventually, everybody is hoarse and nobody can be heard. All right? Logic is again the same. That if you keep your voice down, it won't help because other people are talking more loudly and now you can't be heard. And yet you are all worse off than if everybody kept their voice down. The general problem is that my act imposes costs on you. Yours impose costs on me. Each of them maximizes his own objectives, which mostly ignore costs on other people unless they're people you care about. And that might make us all worse off. The standard examples in economics, which some of you have doubtless encountered, are externalities and public goods. There are others, but those are the two main ones. An externality is a case where my action produces either a positive or a negative effect on other people. Public good is essentially the same problem, same situation where I am doing something which benefits a bunch of people, but I can't control who gets it and therefore can't charge for it. Now, radio broadcast would be a standard example. Now, it turns out that there are sometimes ingenious solutions to problems of this sort. For example, combining radio broadcast with advertisements. But there is no guarantee that there always will be. There's no theoretical reason to believe that in all such situations there will be a way in which the desirable outcome can be reached by voluntary activity. And to see why, simply think about any case where my act produces small costs or small benefits for a very large number of other people. And in such a situation, it's hard to see how either bargaining or suing people or any other mechanism within what libertarians think of as a proper laissez-faire society is going to solve the problem. So what I've just given you is the economist's case for government. That a sufficiently wise and benevolent ruler could keep us from doing things that on net harm us by regulating air pollution or charging for depletion of the aquifer, the body of water under the ground that wells are drawing up from, could get us to do things that on net benefit us by subsidizing basic research, by requiring everybody to get vaccinated. And that is why most economists are not anarchists or even hardcore libertarians. Economists are more libertarian as a rule than other social scientists, much more than anthropologists, for example, or sociologists. But nonetheless, I'm an outlier. But what's wrong with that argument? What I'm trying to do tonight is to both explain why certain arguments are bad arguments and then offer where there are substitutes that I think are good arguments. And the problem with that argument is that there is a striking shortage of wise, benevolent, and all-powerful rulers. What I described in a book a long time ago as a philosopher king, whatever you want to call it, the way the government actually runs is, in effect, a market. It's a very different kind of market, but people offer political support, donations, votes, and so forth. And then the individuals within the political market interact in a way that produces outcomes. Market failure, as I've just described it, occurs when an actor does not bear the net cost of his actions, when either he imposes costs on others, and gets the benefit, or bears costs himself and produces benefits for other people. In either case, he has the wrong incentives because he's only looking at outcomes for himself. The market failure occurs on the private market, but it's the exception, not the rule. if you think about how things work on the market, normally if I want to impose the cost on you of spending 8 hours a day working for me instead of playing World of Warcraft, I've got to offer you a good enough wage so that's not a net cost to you. I've got to compensate you. If I want to use your land or your house, I've got to offer a rental price at which you are no worse off, otherwise you won't accept it. So as a general rule on the market, we have to pay for the costs we impose. And as a general rule, we get paid for the benefits we produce, because if you want me to cut your lawn, you've got to be willing to pay me to do it. All right? So although there are cases such as public good problems and externalities where the private market exhibits market failure, where the wrong thing happens, those are the exceptions, not the rule. If you think about the political market, on the other hand, market failure conditions are the normal situation. That is to say, if you think through the logic of any of the players, individual voters, legislators, judges, or lobbyists, each of them is bearing costs that are not the total costs, receiving benefits, not the total benefit. The standard example is to explain why it is rational for voters to be ignorant. That the individual voter correctly believes, in a big polity like the U.S., that the chance that his vote will affect the outcome is very close to zero, perhaps 1 in 10 million for a presidential election. It is true that getting the less bad person elected president is a large benefit, but it's a large benefit shared among 300 million people. So if I bear a cost to make it more likely, I'm only getting a tiny fraction of the benefit. So therefore, it is almost never in your rational interest to be well informed as a way of changing who's elected president. It might be in your interest if you enjoy politics or if you like arguing with your friends, but not as a means of controlling the government. Similarly, you can run through it. A judge makes a decision which sets a precedent. If he gets the precedent wrong, that might make the national income lower by 1/10,000th, say, by making, in effect, a bad legal rule. That's an enormous amount of damage for a single human being to do, billions of dollars a year. He'll never know it. And similarly for all the rest. So since the people making the decisions never bear much of the cost or receive much of the benefit of their acts, that means that you are normally going to have market failure. And therefore, shifting decisions from the private to the political market is more likely to cause market failure than to prevent it. So the argument libertarians ought to be making is not pretending that market failure doesn't exist, but observing that market failure indeed exists, and it's one of the reasons governments shouldn't have power, because we can expect market failure on the political market and will only occasionally experience it on the private market. Let me go on to climate change, which is a subject I've spent too much time arguing with. I should say a year or two ago, my younger son persuaded me that the custom of giving up something for Lent was a useful custom. So I gave up arguing climate issues on the Facebook climate group for Lent. And it was a correct decision. This was after I had concluded that almost nobody on either side of those arguments understood how the greenhouse effect worked. So let me talk about the bad arguments against the conventional view on climate change. Right? The conventional view is the globe is getting hotter, people are the reason, the results are going to be terrible, and we should therefore do something serious about it. That's sort of the orthodoxy that you see. One bad argument is the claim that it isn't happening. Exactly how much warming is happening is not certain. However, we've got evidence both from ground stations and from satellites, which show that temperatures have been trending up since about 1911 or so. Nobody of the critics has succeeded in explaining away all of it, although some people have argued that it's overestimated for one reason or another. Another bad argument is the claim that it isn't our fault. It's true that climate is a very complicated system, so exactly how much of the change is due to what is something we don't really know. But we do know that the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has gone up by quite a lot. That's pretty easy to measure. The relevant theory tells us that should cause some warming. If people are curious during the question period later, I'll be happy to run through that because most people don't actually understand it. And warming is happening. So it seems plausible that at least an important cause of warming, maybe not the only cause, is indeed human action. Furthermore, it doesn't really matter very much whether we're causing it. That is to say, that's one of the oddest things about the whole climate debate, is how much of it is about, is it our fault? But suppose it's not our fault. Suppose it's really true that warming is catastrophic and is occurring for some other reason. We should still find some way of trying to stop it, right? It isn't a question of who gets blamed. It's a question of what has what consequences. What I think is the right argument in criticizing the current orthodoxy. If it's the case that a ton of CO2 in the air imposes a net cost on the world of $1,000, then the standard economic argument implies that you should tax CO2 at $1,000 a ton so people will only produce it when the value of producing it is larger than the cost. But for that argument to go through, you have to know what the cost is. And I am going to claim that we not only don't know how large the cost is, we don't know if it's positive or negative. Because if you really think about the effects of a warming climate, or more generally of increased CO2, there are both positive and negative externalities. Both can be quite large, and both are fairly uncertain in size. For example, as we are told over and over again, if temperatures go up, more people will die in hot summers. As we were told much less often, fewer people will die in cold winters. It happens that The Lancet, which is the British high-end medical magazine, had an article quite a while back which tried to estimate total global deaths from heat and from cold. And their calculation was that total global deaths from cold were nearly 20 times as large as from heat. Now, we don't know that it would be symmetric as temperature goes up and down, but that at least suggests that if you're going to try to work out the effects, you want to allow for both. And a further reason, which I, again, can go into in the question period if people are curious, is that it turns out from the logic of the greenhouse effect that you tend to get more warming in cold places and cold seasons than in hot places and hot seasons. So in that respect, the pattern of warming is biased in our favor, since generally warming is a bad thing when it's hot and a good thing when it's cold. It is pretty clear that global warming results in sea level rise, much less than a lot of the rhetoric implies. You're talking the high end of the IPCC estimate for the end of this century is about a meter. And that's assuming a high estimate for emissions and then taking the high of the uncertainty range. So a meter is high. Roughly speaking, on the U.S. East Coast, a meter of sea level rise moves the coastline in by 100 meters. So we're really talking about a change which, if there is no diking at all, if there's no defense, means that the Atlantic coast moves in by 100 meters, which is less than a tenth of a mile. So it's a very small effect, but it is a real effect. On the other hand, as it may occur to you if you look at a globe, that there are people living on the equator and not at the pole, that human land use is limited almost entirely by cold, not by heat. As temperatures go up, the temperature contours shift towards the poles, which means that land that used to be unusable by humans becomes barely usable. Land that used to be barely usable becomes a little bit more usable, and so forth. So you're talking about an increase in usable land on a very rough estimate. I've never seen anyone do the calculation right, but I did a sort of back-of-the-envelope calculation which suggested that the gain in land from the temperature contours shifting is between 100 and 1,000 times as large as the loss from sea level rise. Now, to be fair, coastal land tends to be very valuable, so it's not acre-for-acre exchange, but it's probably not 1,000 times as valuable or even 100 times as valuable. And as I like to put it, Canada, which makes a big fuss about global warming, a reasonable amount of global warming, and Canada's twice as big. Because Canada, on a map, goes way up here, but Canada is really a thin strip of usable land north of the U.S.-Canadian boundary. I oversimplify a little, but not very much. So you've got a cost and a benefit. The best established fact about all of this is CO2 fertilization, because people who have greenhouses have for many years been pumping in CO2 in order to raise crop yields. And roughly speaking, there are two different mechanisms for photosynthesis, referred to as C3 and C4. Most crop plants are C3. Some maize and sugarcane are C4. The rough estimate is that if you double the CO2 concentration, the yield of C3 crops goes up by 30%. So that's a huge, and doubling is about what IPCC is talking about happening by the end of the century. So that's a huge increase in crop yields. C4 also increases, but not by as much, and it's not as well established by how much. Now, people argue that we're going to have terrible food problems because warming might result in droughts, or it might not. The IPCC claimed in its fourth report that warming was causing droughts, and in the fifth report they retracted that claim. It's not at all clear that you would expect it to. It might not. It means that evaporation is higher, but also that there's more water vapor in the air. It might cause various other things. But the only effect we can be reasonably sure of is the CO2 fertilization. Now, there are other effects. In particular, the one I'm least certain of is lowering the pH of the oceans. That carbon dioxide dissolved in water is carbonic acid. And the term acidification is a little misleading because the oceans are, in fact, basic. They've got a pH on the basic side of neutral. So what you're really doing is moving the pH a little bit towards neutral. But nonetheless, all the things that live in the ocean are currently adapted to the current environment. And I don't think we know whether a reduction of the scale likely to happen from CO2 in the atmosphere is or is not going to be a serious problem. But it could be. I mean, I don't want to overstate my case or to claim that we know that warming is a good thing, because the claim I'm really making is that we do not know whether it's good or a bad thing. We don't know the size or the sign of the net externality, the sum of all the effects. The effects are spread over an uncertain future. The amount of CO2 output depends on future technology. That is this odd thing that the same people both tell us solar power is getting cheaper and cheaper and cheaper, and really nobody should bother with fossil fuels anyway, and use IPCC projections, which assume that we keep putting more and more CO2 into the air. If it really turns out the technological change means that some alternative, whether that's solar power or nuclear power or thermonuclear power or wind power, if it turns out that some alternative really is clearly cheaper than fossil fuels, we'll mostly stop burning fossil fuels and the CO2 will stop going up. Furthermore, the cost of dealing with the effects depend on technology and on economic development. That people say, look, Bangladesh is a low-lying coast. They're going to have problems dealing with even a modest amount of sea level rise. But you're talking about changes over a century. If Bangladesh follows the pattern that China has followed, in a century, Bangladesh will be able to dike its coasts out of small change. They will no longer be a poor country. So we don't know. The climate science is quite uncertain. Climate sensitivity tells you how much temperatures go up for a given increase in CO2. And estimates of sensitivity range over roughly a factor of 3. And different people have different estimates. We don't have good ones. The physics is complicated enough so you can't calculate it out on theoretical grounds. It isn't clear whether hurricanes and drought are going to get worse or not. People talk as if they were. They might. But again, these are complicated systems. So far, those things have not happened. An uncertain positive plus an uncertain negative could add up to a positive or a negative net effect. We don't know if we should tax carbon or subsidize it. All right. let me now make a comment about the public debate, as it were. Suppose you start out, for whatever reason, thinking that restricting CO2 output is a good thing because you don't like coal-burning things, you're worried about air pollution, which is a legitimate problem, any reason we like. In that case, when you're trying to estimate the net effect of global warming, you take a high estimate for climate sensitivity to make the effect large. For all of the negative effects, you make the highest estimate you can plausibly justify. For all the positive effects, you make the lowest estimate you can plausibly justify. You miss some of the positive effects because you're not looking for them. And you say, look, science proves we should restrict CO2. If you have the opposite schedule, you follow the opposite policy and you say climate shows that CO2 is good. And one of my favorite things that I came across in this debate was that cartoon. Because the cartoon was clearly put up by people who were worried about global warming and wanted to persuade other people to. But what that climate tells me is that the people who are worried about global warming would be in favor of exactly the same policies if they weren't in favor of global warming. Hence, I shouldn't believe them, right? For the same reason you don't believe advertisements. That you know that if somebody has got an axe to grind, he wants a particular conclusion, he's going to bias his arguments to get that conclusion. And although the conclusion might be true, the fact that people who want you to believe this say it's true is no reason to believe it. What's neat about the cartoon is the fact that it was put up by people who didn't see that. By people who were so sure that everything they were in favor of was good that it just didn't occur to them that anybody might be suspicious of their motives. Because they're the best of motives. All of us have the best of motives, right? From our standpoint. Finally, consider the two alternative responses to global warming, or climate change more generally. One of them is trying to prevent it, and one of them is trying to adapt to it, to alter things. So adapting means farmers changing what crop they grow if the climate changes a little. It means people putting in air conditioning where they didn't have it before, not bothering to put as much insulation on their houses in places like New Hampshire or Vermont, where it still gets rather chilly in the winter, things of that sort. There's a practical problem. Suppose you believe that preventing CO2 is a good thing. There's a practical problem in doing it, because preventing it faces a public good problem, that an individual or even a country that chooses to use expensive solar power instead of cheap natural gas power is bearing all the cost of doing it to hold down CO2, and it's sharing the benefit with the world. So that means that at either the individual or even the national level, you have the problem of how you get people to do something when they bear the cost and somebody else gets the benefit. And it's even worse for global warming, because if you really think about it seriously, some of the countries are clearly going to be better off with global warming, even if on net it turns out to be a bad thing. All right? The Canadians should be burning everything they can. All right? They aren't, but that's ideology, not science. Adaptation is at least closer to being a private good, that a single farmer who shifts crops gets all of the benefits. A city that dikes against flooding, it's a public good for the individuals in the city, but for the city as a whole, it's a private good, so that the city government has an incentive to the extent it does the right things to try to protect itself. As some of you may know, the lowest city in the Netherlands is, what, 13 meters? 10 or 13? I think something like... something more than 10 meters, I think, below sea level. The Dutch solved the problem of living below sea level using medieval technology centuries ago. They do it with higher tech now. We are much better at producing private goods than public goods. So that means that if you imagine the optimal thing to do with CO2 is this, the optimal thing to do in adaptation of that, we're not going to do anything close to the optimum here. We're going to come much closer here. Furthermore, as I've just been discussing, warming produces both good and bad effects. If you prevent the warming, you lose the good effects as well as the bad effects. If you adapt, you keep the good effects, and you at least reduce the bad effects. You minimize. So warming happens, you build dikes to prevent flooding, and you get to move farther north and
well, the south, there isn't much land until you get to Antarctica, but you get extra land in Scandinavia and Siberia and Canada and such places. Let me go on to another bad argument, and this one I presume is not made by everybody because some of you are minarchists and not really hardcore believers in the market like the rest of us. But the argument that's wrong is the claim that anarchy always works so that it's always better. And if you try to think through the logic of market anarchy, you ought to realize that there are at least two failure modes, two ways it can fail to work. One of them is conquest by a foreign state, and the other is internal failure as the institutions within that market anarchy, in effect, reinvent government because it's in the interest of people to do so. Some people, the ones who do it. All right. So if you think about the logic, defense against nations is, again, a public good. If I've got an anti-missile or a laser that shoots down incoming ICBMs, I don't get to say to each individual in the country, you'll get blown up if you don't pay me. All right, I can't control who gets it. Therefore, there are serious problems without a government in producing national defense. There are serious problems with a government because you end up trying to defend the U.S. border in Iraq or various other distant places, so it's not clear that's optimum. But on the other hand, we'd rather not be conquered. And it doesn't do a whole lot of good to eliminate your government if the result is that another and perhaps worse government takes over. So there are various imperfect ways in which we do produce public goods. And again, I've got long discussions of this elsewhere. But there is no guarantee they will succeed. And that's going to depend on how hard a problem it is and on various features of the society that affect how well we can manage to raise the resources to defend ourselves. The other problem is if you imagine a society where rights enforcement is a private activity and there are private firms that you contract with to protect your rights and settle your disputes, if there are 500 such firms, any one of them that starts violating rights, you just hire someone else to protect you. If there are three such firms, on the other hand, you have a potential problem. The heads of those firms might decide that robbery is more profitable than selling a voluntary service. They might make an agreement with each other. We won't accept your customers. You won't accept our customers. And now we can charge our whatever price we like, set whatever terms we like without worrying about competition. So that tells you that there are at least two possible ways in which a market anarchy could fail to work and could indeed end up being worse than what we have, depending on just how that failure turns out. A better argument, better because I think it's true, is that market anarchy will work in some environments. It will work in environments where the external threats are weak enough and the various imperfect solutions to defending strong enough, so it probably won't be conquered. And I should say, as evidence that it is sometimes possible to have quite effective military without a government, my standard example is the Comanche Indians. They were facing an opponent with vastly superior technology, enormously larger population, and for quite a long time, the problem was how everybody else was going to defend against them. They basically prevented expansion across Texas for something like 2 decades, as I remember. And they eventually lost, but they lost against very, very heavy odds. So they happened to have a culture in which raiding the Mexicans and the Americans for slaves and horses was a profitable private activity, got them status as well as wealth. They were very, very good at it in a culture which encouraged those sorts of skills. So one can imagine that's sort of at one extreme. And if you want to look at some of my ideas on how you might do it in a modern society, the first edition of Machinery of Freedom has one chapter on national defense, the hard problem, and the third edition has another chapter expanding on that. Similarly, for the other problem, that you need a society where the market for rights protection is big enough and the economies of scale in the job small enough so that in equilibrium you have many firms instead of a few firms. That those of you familiar with economics will know that the normal situation in any field is that as firms get bigger, they first get more efficient and less efficient. That you take advantage of mechanical economies of scale, but you're adding more and more layers between the president and the factory floor. So the result is that a firm of one person is probably not optimal. A firm of 100 or 1,000 might be, and a firm of 100,000 probably isn't. And that varies with different fields. We don't know what it's going to be in rights enforcement, but you need, in order for the system to be reasonably safe, you need a situation where in equilibrium there are a fairly substantial number of rights enforcement agencies, so they're competing with each other. All right? And the final claim, which I think I can justify but not tonight, is that where it works, it is superior to the alternatives. That the basic problem with minarchy is that we have no way of making that government, of making it in the interest of that government to do the right things. That it isn't fair to say, I'm going to have a minarchy in which the law is X, Y, and Z, because you're not going to be able to control it. Given a set of institutions, those institutions will produce what is in the interest of the players in that game to produce, and we have a good deal of evidence suggesting that even with a fairly small government, that's not the outcome we want. So the claim, therefore, is that market anarchy is a viable alternative. It will work in some circumstances and not in others. And as I say, for details, see the third edition of Machinery. Let me now make the general case for what I've been trying to do tonight in defense of modest arguments. Not violating rights is important, but it's not infinitely important. And if you pretend it is, you end up making claims you can't defend, describing behavior you wouldn't really do, saying I would let go of the flagpole when you know damn well you wouldn't. Property rights are a very useful technology, but they're a complicated one. They're not something you can just get two sentences and that explains everything. Laissez-faire is not perfect. In a laissez-faire society, there will be some things worth doing that don't get done, and there are some things not worth doing that do get done. It is only better than any alternative we have, because the same problems that make it imperfect make at least all the alternatives we know about more imperfect. Climate change is real. It is very likely that it is due to human action, but there is no good reason to think it will be catastrophic, and it may well turn out to be on net good rather than bad. We will observe that I made a mistake in setting up this PowerPoint slide. That last thing was supposed to come at the end. You can't hear me? Yeah, I'm just about at the end. Why shouldn't we make bad arguments? All right. First reason is a moral reason. Because honesty is something we care about for its own sake. And we in particular should care about it because the two ways we think of violating rights are force and fraud, and dishonesty is a form of fraud. Furthermore, from a practical standpoint, bad arguments only convince stupid people, and that's not who we want in our movement, right? We want intelligent people to hear about libertarianism to say, yeah, that might be right. And if they say, nah, this is the kind of thing that only nutty, simple-minded people believe, they're going to go off and become socialists instead or something else. Maybe if they listen to the socialists, they won't do that either for the same reason. But there'll be something else. All right. So that's really the end of what I have to say. My webpage is daviddfriedman.com. I should have put it as the last slide, but I forgot. And from my webpage, you can get to my blog. And on my webpage, there are links to a good many, most of my articles and a fair number of my books that you can read for free. Thank you.